From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and naturalist Philip Hose was looking for a species to profile. He wanted to write about a bird in danger of becoming extinct. And the Rufa redknot was perfect. It's a shorebird about the size of a robin. And over the last 20 years or so, its numbers have crashed. But Hose was looking for one charismatic character, not a nameless flock. Then he learned about B95. It's one redknot, and that's its band number, B95. He was captured first 20 years ago, and this little creature has become almost a celebrity among certain birders and biologists. And not so much for his personality as his sheer will to live. Today in the program, Philip Hose will join us to talk about B95. It's a bird he calls the toughest 4 ounces of life in the world. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For many of us, seeing a flock of shorebirds at the beach may be pleasant enough, but they don't always inspire awe. For one thing, to the untrained eye, they all pretty much look the same. And this was the problem the writer and naturalist Philip Hose had to confront when he was looking for a species to profile. Hose had already written about the ivory-billed woodpecker, and he was looking for a bird in danger of becoming extinct. The Rufa redknot certainly qualified. It's a small shorebird whose numbers have started to seriously decline. Over the last 20 years or so, 80% of their population has disappeared. But Hose is a writer, and he knows you need characters to tell a story. He had plenty of characters in the biologists and conservationists who were working to protect the redknot, but he needed at least one bird to profile, not a nameless flock. And then he learned about B95. That's the band number of one bird in particular. He was first captured nearly 20 years ago, and this creature has almost become kind of a celebrity among birders and biologists, and here's why. First, he has stayed alive, despite the odds, but also for his stamina. Each year, red knots travel from the bottom of the world to the top of the world. It's 18,000 miles round trip. And someone figured that B95, mind you, an animal who weighs about 4 ounces, had flown more than 325,000 miles in his life. It's the distance to the moon and nearly halfway back. So Hose had the character he needed for his book. Philip Hose is coming to Utah this week, and today he's joining us to talk about his book. It's called Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with the Great Survivor B95. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Philip Hose is the author of a number of books, including The Race to Save the Lord Godbird. That's the one about the ivory-billed woodpecker. Also, Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice, which won the National Book Award. He's also a staff member with the Nature Conservancy. And just for full disclosure, I should mention my wife also works for the Nature Conservancy. Philip Hose will be in town to discuss the book, and he's joining us today from a studio in Portland, Maine. Philip Hose, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Doug. It's great to hear your voice again, and it's great to get a break from shoveling.
I imagine. I guess I wanted to start, and I may have asked you this before, but I'm interested in how it is you describe and explain, I guess, your affection for birds. You've talked about the fact that you grew up around birders, so I guess it's always been sort of a part of your life. But how do you describe your own personal connection to birds?
Gosh, that's a great question. I just love them. You know, I admire them. I think they're beautiful. I love the places that they take you. If you want to see, you know, all the birds of North America, let's say, you wind up in some really raw and beautiful places. And I admire the complexity of their lives. I want to know more about them. It seems like the more you know, the deeper you want to go, and that was certainly the case with B95. When I began my research, I knew very little about shorebirds. Shorebirds are an underknown, underappreciated group. They're just these little blurry-legged things that chase the waves and get chased by the waves. But when you dig deeper and look at what they experience in a year, it's phenomenal what they go through and what they can do.
Mm. You've talked about how there came a time in your life as a writer, and I guess as a naturalist or as a conservationist, that you wanted to write about extinction. And the book I mentioned about the ivory-billed woodpecker, that was the result. You wrote about that, and I wondered, what was it about extinction in particular that you wanted to say or you wanted to write about?
Well, just the finality of it,
yeah.
And I wanted to bring to a reader's attention that extinction is preventable, and it's tragic, and it's worth everybody's attention. When a life form disappears, you don't get a second chance. And I passionately believe that we need to look at life forms on their own terms and try to understand them rather than letting them go.
We spoke several years ago about that book about the ivory-billed woodpecker. And for a time, I remember it was right around the time your book came out, which was kind of amazing. But there was this burst of excitement that the woodpecker had been found in this Arkansas swamp. But now I guess there's some consensus anyway that it wasn't an ivory bill. And there's been a lot of debate about it. Where did you find yourself in all of that at the time?
To be honest, I found myself growing angrier by the week almost. I was on a book tour, a long book tour.
Yeah.
I went to, I think, 26 states in a year and made nearly 100 appearances. And the supposed rediscovery came about in the third month after the book had been published. And the presentations that I would make, there'd be a PowerPoint that I would narrate, a PowerPoint of the book's images, and then I'd ask for questions and try to get into a colloquy.
Yeah.
It all changed. It's as if the discussion got hijacked. Now, after the book, the bird was perhaps rediscovered, everybody wanted to know the same thing. I'd say any questions and there'd be a forest of hands and I'd say yes. And they'd say it was like the McCarthy hearings, Doug. It was, do you believe?
Yeah.
Do you believe? And there was no good answer. You know, if you said, yes, I believe that the bird found in the Arkansas swamp was an ivory-billed woodpecker, presumed extinct for nearly half a century, you could almost sense people snickering.
Yeah.
And if you said, no, I don't believe it, it was as if, my inner Phil had died and I had no hope and no joy.
Right.
It was nuts. I mean, I actually had a couple people come up to me at book signing tables and touch me. They wanted to touch me. It was as if I were channeling, something, hope or whatever.
Yeah. But I'm not sure where you are at this point. I guess you don't know. Like most people don't know. But I was interested in whether or not writing that book taught you any lessons about extinction, or even that process where you talk about being really angry. That's interesting that you were really angry. What did you learn from that experience, I guess, do you think?
Well, I guess I learned a couple of things. One thing was I really got into the ivory-billed woodpecker. I talked to people who had seen it, and there was this great sense of really, mourning and grief and sorrow that such a bird, could never be again. It was such a spectacular creature, both in habit and in circumstance and in environment. The swamps were dramatic places. The bird itself was a dramatic bird that seemed to strike everyone that ever saw it. Theodore Roosevelt, who went on a great bear hunt down in Mississippi and Louisiana around the turn of the 20th century, said that the ivory bill struck him, he put it, just as much as any of the objects of the chase, meaning bears. It was just a bird that everyone wanted to talk about and everyone wanted back. And so the finality of extinction really got to me. And I wanted, as I said, to tell my readers, to convince them through characters and through all the devices that any fiction writer has, that this is a tragedy and that it's a preventable tragedy.
So you have on one hand the ivory-billed woodpecker, one of the most dramatic birds you can think of in some ways, and then contrast that now with a red knot, the roofer red knot. Which seems, just on the face, it seems like the polar opposite, a bird that's almost nondescript. There's almost seems to be no drama associated until you really look in there. But what were you thinking?
Well, I loved that. You know, it isn't quite true, I don't think, because if you see the bird in its breeding plumage, it's sort of this bright brick red plumage. Yeah. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous bird. So it does have that, you know, that asset. But you're right. You know, shorebirds are very poorly understood. They have not been studied thoroughly compared to other groups of birds. And they all look nondescript and they all sort of look alike and unless you start looking very carefully at them. Yeah. And I really liked that. I mean, it was quite a challenge. It's a challenge that I took on. I mean, not only do you not have a human character for your reader to identify, you don't even get a pet. I mean, a red knot is not going to curl up with you, you know,
yeah.
or curl up at your feet. I mean, you really have to meet these birds on their own terms and dig deeply to understand anything about their lives. I thought it was a terrific challenge. It was in that sense, and I think that's what you're getting at, it was a harder book to write than The Race to Save the Lord God Bird because
yeah.
ivory-billed woodpeckers are so charismatic.
Yeah.
They grabbed everyone's attention. And these little shorebirds, even B95, are very, very obscure, and you have to work to bring your reader to them.
Let's talk about B95 himself. You describe him in the book as this sort of perfectly formed male, long bill, really powerful chest, the most celebrated shorebird in the world. That's for sure. And it was so interesting when you hear people talk about him in the book, some of the biologists and conservationists who've had the privilege of seeing him, it's like they found a celebrity almost.
Well, it's really true. And the people who have held him, you know, to band him, they're becoming rock stars too. Patricia Gonzalez in Argentina, you know, is the number one example. He's really a big deal now. There are two statues being erected of B95, one in a little town called Rio Grande in Tierra del Fuego, which is a place that he's been seen four times. So City Council of Rio Grande declared him the city's natural ambassador, and children made a play about him, and they're busily erecting a statue of B95 now. Mm. And there's already a statue at a nature reserve in Delaware. So he's really caught the world's attention. When he was last seen on May 28th, just this last year, a few months ago, It just sent a jolt through the scientific world. The New York Times was right in touch and devoted a full page almost in their Green Science blog to it. So it's really quite a bird.
One researcher from Argentina said when he spotted him, it was the happiest day of his life.
Well, there is that. And of course, it was a lot of fun to interview scientists and to work with them. I got to be on banding crews and ask them, why? You know, how can this bird have lived so much longer than his life expectancy? And it is a he. B95 is a he.
Yeah.
And there were all sorts of answers. You know, the most frequent one, the most common one was, well, it's just genes. You know, some people live to be 100.
Yeah.
But others said he was more adaptable. You know, to be a successful red knot, you have to change very, very quickly, just gusts of wind or circumstances that aren't the way you might have expected them to be based on your prior life experience of these places. And you have to figure it out very quickly. So some people sort of said, well, he's the quickest learner mm-hmm. of all of them. One sort of novel idea was that he has a genius for the center of the flock, meaning that, for example, when a peregrine falcon is trying to harry one bird in an aerial maneuver out of a shape-shifting flock, he stays toward the middle. Or when human scientists are trying to capture a group of shorebirds with a rocket-propelled net, he's in the middle rather than the edges. Of course, there's no evidence for that at all. But it's reached a point with B95 where it's fun to speculate, how is he doing it?
Yeah. It's interesting that you refer to him as B95. Were you at all tempted to give him a name?
No, not at all.
Yeah. Why?
B95 seemed, you know, miraculous enough
yeah,
that we could identify one one bird. So I'm content.
Yeah. Of course, behind this, you know, very particular story is a bigger story and a big question. Here's how you put it in the book. Can humans and shore birds coexist? Is that the essence of the story in some way?
Well, in a way it is. The North American shorebird conservation strategy identifies 53 shorebirds that breed in North America, of which, according to them, 27 are in real peril, steep slides. And I think, you know, that they're good indicators. Healthy populations of shorebirds are good indicators of healthy coasts. And I think that's the real trick here for conservationists and just for people in general is to take good care of coastal areas so that the marshy buffers, the coral reefs, the oyster reefs, and so forth that provide natural buffers for humans and human dwellings and so forth exist, but also healthy coasts and abundant food resources for shorebirds so that they can continue to exist as well. Mm. It's a crisis. I tried to put – I think what you're suggesting here, Doug, is that I really did try to put a face, I guess with a beak,
yeah,
on a crisis, on a global crisis. Shorebirds are disappearing everywhere. As you suggested in your introduction, you know, 80% of the roofer red knots that were alive when B-95 was born are gone now. He's flying with ever smaller flocks. And if you look at all the stopover points along his 18,600-mile annual circuit, you see all sorts of problems. They're not the same. You know, there is a disappearing food resource at Delaware Bay, the horseshoe crab eggs, and you've got hunters in another part of it, and you've got turbulent air, which may be caused by climate change in particular legs of his journey. It's going to take coordinated action by political jurisdictions that aren't used to cooperating with one another, and it's going to take real insight from biologists, and it's going to take real restraint and discipline on behalf of the beach-going public.
Philip Hose is with us. His new book is called Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with the Great Survivor, B-95. He's coming to Salt Lake City this Friday for an event at the King's English Bookshop. It begins at 6 o'clock. You can visit our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about an extraordinary bird. It's a shorebird, a Rufa redknot. And every year, this creature travels from one end of the world to the other. Our guest is the writer and naturalist Philip Hose, who is coming to Utah this week. He's written a book about the redknot. In fact, it's about the gifts of one particular bird, banded as B-95. He calls him among the toughest 4 ounces of life in the world. You can join us if you like, if you have questions or comments. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. And we should mention Philip Hose will be at the King's English Bookshop on Friday. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. So you try and sort of create the story of B-95 from what we know. Where do you figure he would have been born, most likely? I guess Canada.
He would have been born on an island in the central Canadian Arctic. There are a batch of islands north of Hudson Bay, and that's where really all the roofer red knot breeding habitat is.
And it's kind of an interesting story. I think that they're born. They hang out with their parents for a short amount of time, and it isn't long before they're pretty much on their own.
It's an amazing story. It's one that, in a way, makes no sense to me. the parents, the prospective parents, get up there having gorged on horseshoe crab eggs, if they're lucky, for a fuel source, and they blast off, and it's a 1,500, maybe 2,000-mile flight to the breeding grounds, and they have to have packed on enough extra fat to tide them over in case there's still snow on the ground and in case the ponds are frozen and lock in their next food source, which is mosquitoes. But if they're lucky and patient, the ponds indeed thaw, the mosquitoes are released, and it's chow time again, and males and females pair off. They lay four little green eggs, and these birds late in June hatch, and they're precocial is the word, meaning that they can do almost anything that they'll ever need to do in life on day one. They can kind of step out of their eggshell, walk down to the water, start feeding. And as you suggest, they lose their parents right away after about 3 weeks of hanging around and gaining strength. The females who surrender 60% of their body weight in those four eggs are strong enough to make a flight, and they gather together, and the moms basically desert the family. So the dads do childcare, and they hang around for another 3 or 4 weeks. And their duties, their chief duty, besides brooding keeping the kids warm at night, is to fend away predators like jaegers and snowy owls and Arctic foxes. But then the dads get together and fly off too, and they leave these rookies, these kids, having not a clue, growing their flight feathers, starting to make these little flights out over the water until the urge to go stirs in the kids too, and they take off as well. Mm. So that's the part I asked a lot of people about that. Why does that make sense? And I never got an answer that satisfied me.
What's it like to see them in a flock? I mean, hundreds of them in some cases together moving. You say in the book it's like if they were controlled by a single mind.
Oh, that's exactly it. And shorebirds are cliquish even – I mean red knots are cliquish even among shorebirds. Their flocks are very, very tight. I think the biggest thrill with red knots I ever had was I got to see them depart one day. I was in New Jersey along Delaware Bay on Reed's Beach, and there's this house where a lot of research takes place and with a great big deck. And it was on May 28th one year, a couple years ago, and I was still hanging around. And sure enough, you know, the late afternoon happened, and they got together in a big flock, and the behavior was different. I mean, usually at that time of night, they're headed a few miles to the beach, to the ocean side for roosting, but this time they were definitely up to something else. They just sort of swung back and forth like the pendulum on a clock, almost like they were taking readings, you know, and then they swirled up into the air, and they just took off, bound north. It was goosebump, you know, chilling.
Well, it's interesting because you say that when you talk about how it sweeps back and forth like that, like they are getting their bearings in some way. You write that in some way they sort of set their inner GPS. Is it something like that? Do we know? I mean, because the big question is how it is they navigate.
Yeah, it really is, and there's still a lot of work to be done in that. One idea, and it's a pretty predominant idea, is that this rookie flock – let's go back to the Arctic again, Doug.
Yeah.
And here are these kids that don't know anything really, that they do have an inner GPS. That is, something is telling them – since they have no experience of navigating by the stars or the Earth's magnetic field or by landforms, which are acquired, learned sort of information that help you later on. When you're a rookie and you've never done it before, you need some help. And one idea is that they have a almost like in a car, a GPS, somebody saying, you know, go 500 miles north and then turn left, you know, 125 miles and so forth. And they – They make it, although I might say that according to the Canadian Endangered Species Report on roofer red knots, 55% of them do not make that first year. They die in their first year. It's too much. But that's the way it is with a lot of migrating birds. If you can survive the first year, you know, you can live a few years.
And you said
all 20.
Well, not 20. Well, I guess that was the question that came to me. I wondered, I thought, well, now is B95 really that extraordinary, or are there a lot of these old timers? I mean, do you have any sense of that?
I don't know of any other old timers. There are certainly birds in their early teens, but I don't know of any survivors left from the first banding expedition in 1995. I'm not saying that he is it for sure. It's just that I don't think we found any.
He's
the oldest known, recognizable individual.
How is it that this little creature can fly so far? I mean, it's a question you ask in the book. And you say the secret is a feat of bodybuilding, how they kind of transform themselves. Talk about that, because that's really interesting.
Well, they become flight machines. They you mentioned in the opening that they're robin-sized, and because they're so small, they cannot pack on enough fuel to make it nonstop. So they have to stop a few times along the way to refuel. And they it's amazing to watch them pack on fuel. They eat and they eat and they eat, and they convert all the protein that they eat, a typical food. Where they are now is down in Tierra del Fuego, where if B95 is alive, that's where he is now, which is, as you know, below the tip of South America. It's way down at the bottom of the world. And what he's doing right now is molting, that is exchanging his wing feathers to get ready for a big new flight. And also, especially as we get into March, he's going to be eating and eating and eating. And what he's eating is spat, which is young mussels. And he's just fueling up, porking up, and he has all these air sacs in him which fill up and fill up to store fuel. Mm. He's converting everything to fat because fat is by far the most efficient flight fuel. But beyond just inflating, his heart is getting much bigger. The sinews that connect his wings to the rest of the body are getting tougher, and he's ditching weight. The organs that he's not going to be using, such as a gizzard to grind hard food, or his leg muscles, they're shriveling and they're losing weight. So by the time he's done with this whole thing, he's a flight machine. It's amazing what they can do. Mm-hmm. And then they are stirred by some inner thing, and off they go, often swinging sort of to get their bearings, and then taking off in a tight flock. Mountaintop height, 45 miles an hour, an incredible, incredible journey.
You say a red knot can consume 14 times its own weight. And you say, if to compare that to a human being, if we were to do that, someone who weighed 110 pounds would have to eat 2,300 hamburgers.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so – I have to say, it's so interesting the way the way they've evolved, just how efficient they've become. You talk about the, you know, they switch gears, they eat softer food and less of it as they get ready. They reduce their body mass, as you talked about. And as you said, I guess there's a kind of a chemical process going on that's urging them to go. Do we really know what that urge is beyond that?
Well, there are experiments, plenty of experiments to show that it exists and that it is hormonal. It is, you know, chemical. The exact nature of it beyond that, I'm not sure I know. One thing that just fascinates me, and I'm sure a lot of other people, is why do they do it?
Yep.
You know, why would you do that? Why would you fly from the bottom of the world to the top to breed and then come back again? Why would you expose yourself to that kind of risk and that kind of hardship? And I think the answer is that they do it to spread out. they don't want to concentrate so many bird species in one area of the country or one area of the world, and so they disperse. They follow really a beam of light and a pulse of food north and then south again. They're sight predators, so they have to see their prey, and they want the greatest lamp that they possibly can. So everywhere they are, really at just about any time of the year, it is at the time when there is the most light and when it's really the warmest. They want to be able to see two tides, two low tides a day rather than one. And that's the advantage of being in Tierra del Fuego right now. It's warm. There's a lot of light. When they finally get up to Delaware Bay, it'll be almost at the solstice, our spring solstice. Mm-hmm. So it's very bright. You can see you have two low tides a day uncovering all this food, horseshoe crab eggs in the case of Delaware Bay. And then in the Arctic, when they're up there breeding, it's, you know, the land of the midnight sun. So they've worked out strategies to share the food really with other species and to follow, to make it so that their journey is, you know, well lit and gives them the most chance for fuel that they could possibly get.
Mm. In 2009, you went to Tierra del Fuego. I guess you're like a lot of the birders who are really interested in B95. You were hoping to see him. But he wasn't among the birds you caught while you were there. But then you write about how you'd returned home, and then I guess it was an email. Somebody had spotted B95, I guess.
Well, yeah. When I first made the decision, I'm going to choose this bird, I'm going to write about this bird, I said to the person who suggested it to me, what do I do now? And he said, can you get on a plane and go down to Ushuaia, which is, you know, Tierra del Fuego? And I said, yeah, I guess I could. What do I do when I get there? He said, if you do that, I can hook you up with a banding crew, which is led by Patricia Gonzalez, who's a well-known bird biologist from Argentina. So I did it. You know, I got on the plane, went all the way down there. It was by far the farthest I'd ever been away from home, and got on her banding crew. And it was, you know, I just learned so much. She taught me everything from, you know, how to hold these birds to, you know, how to read a molt, the molt in a wing, and how to tell from a wing pattern whether the bird that I'm holding here is a juvenile bird or an adult bird. Oh, it was just so fascinating.
That is one part of the book, I have to say, that is interesting, where you profile some of the biologists who work with the birds. And you've said that working on the book gave you a kind of a deeper appreciation for these people. And I guess you said that you hadn't realized just how rugged they were as a group.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you think of a scientist and you think of somebody in a white lab coat, yeah, you know, indoors carrying test tubes around. These people are really, really tough. I mean, they've been to the Arctic. They've slept out in the Arctic. They've followed these birds all over the world into some of the most remote and rugged places that you can be. I mean, the great example to me was Guy Morrison and Ken Ross, who are two biologists for the Canadian Wildlife Service. And in the mid-70s, early 80s, they kind of got tired about knowing of shorebirds only from the Canadian experience. Right. And they wondered, where do they go when they're not in Canada? And they decided to find out. They went down to South America. I don't really know where they started, but neither has a pilot license. And they rented a plane with a local pilot, a piece of equipment they didn't know, and they told the guy to go 150 feet up in the air and hold the course, you know, just go around the coast. And they kept doing that for 4 years until they had entirely circumnavigated the coast of South America, mapping the good shorebird wintering sites as they went along and perfecting methods for counting the number of individuals in a flock. Without them, we'd be, you know, back in the Stone Ages.
Patricia Gonzalez, another you mentioned. Say something about Brian Harrington. He's a shorebird scientist in Massachusetts. Had a something of an epiphany, I guess, about shorebirds or red knots, well, I guess, in it was like 1979 or something.
Yeah, Brian is sort of the, you know, the the one whose shoulders we stand on. He works for the Manomet Conservation Center and in 1972 began to study red knots. He thought that shorebirds were underknown and he wanted one life form really to study. So he chose the roofer red knot and has been studying it ever since. And it's really Brian who made this connection between the huge buildup of shorebirds and especially red knots in the last 2 weeks of May and their feeding on horseshoe crab eggs. As it turns out, horseshoe crabs spawn. They come out of the water to spawn on the full moons of mid to late May where the tides are the highest of any time of the year. And they want to get their eggs above the reach of water so they won't wash away. So out they come, you know, these lumbering armies of horseshoe crabs with males attached by a runner to females. And the females, you know, dig into the sand and they deposit their eggs and they position these little males over them, over the hole, you know, to fertilize it. And then they sometimes four or five males are attached to them. Anyway, this relationship wasn't really known until Brian, I think in 1979, put out a feeler to all the people he knew through a shorebird network that he had built on the Atlantic coast and said, does anybody know where red knots go in the spring? We can't find any records. And nobody answered, not a soul except one, a guy named Joe Lomax, who said, yeah, you know, we got lots of them down here on Reed's Beach. And New Jersey on Delaware Bay. And Brian said, what do you mean by lots of them? And he said, thousands. And so the next year, Brian went down there and Joe Lomax led Brian to a berm, to a rise. And he looked out and here was a big area of beach covered with jabbing, you know, chattering shorebirds, many of which were red knots. And it was, yeah, it was the epiphany. Nobody had really documented that connection before.
Mm. So a comment from our website is asking about whether the lack of horseshoe crab eggs, is that going to wipe out possibly most of what's left of the red knots? Do we know?
It's a real bottleneck. It is because it's the best banquet, the best meal of the year for them. And it's the one place where, you know, 95% of all roofer red knots are attracted to this one place at this one time. And if, as your emailer suggests, those eggs are not there, if the crisis, as many people know, is that horseshoe crabs have been found to be good for bait for eels and whelk. And so they fishermen chop them up, put them in bait pots and lower them over the side. And I guess they're quite fragrant and they attract eels and so forth. Well, this went unregulated and even not really well known for 4 or 5 years. And finally, the biologist thought, wait a minute, where'd all the horseshoe crabs go? We're getting these impossibly low counts. Yeah. And the same with shorebirds. They put two and two together. And now it's been quite a struggle to come up with a strategy that'll please everyone, you know, that'll keep the resource in the bay just for the survival of horseshoe crabs and also for the shorebirds, but also give the fishing industry something. It's pretty tough.
It's amazing to me how delicate the margins are for these birds. I mean, you write, for example, that when the red knots go to Delaware Bay, that they need to gain a certain amount of weight. They need at least 180 grams in order to make it north. Talk about that because they've got to gain weight. This is a really kind of crucial period for them.
Oh, everything is so well defined. It really is, Doug, just the last 2 weeks in May. They show up around the 15th and the most common date of departure is the 28th. And they have got to take advantage of that banquet of horseshoe crab eggs during those 2 weeks that they are there. And if they don't, they won't have the fuel that's required to make it to the Arctic or to withstand another week of winter while everything's covered up and frozen. So they really need to do that. And, you know, as you suggest, I've been on a couple banding crews where I got to be the one who weighed the birds.
Yeah.
And these red knots would come in. I had them as low as 100, 102 grams, and they're bony. I mean, you can just feel with your finger their breastbone poking out. Maybe they're freshly arrived from northern South America, and they've been, you know, burning muscle for the last day or two of their flight. Who knows? But they're just, you look at them, and maybe it's May 20th, and they've got 8-10 days to go, and you just feel these birds and look at them and think, man, you're never going to make it. Mm. And other birds, you know, are just butterballs. They come in at 200, and you wonder why. You know, maybe they came earlier. Maybe they found the good beach. And that's one thing that's happening with the wipeout of horseshoe crabs and their eggs, is that in the old days before this happened, every beach really along Delaware Bay was saturated with horseshoe crab eggs. Now, you know, only so many of them are, and you've got to find them pretty quickly, and you can't waste a lot of energy finding them.
You write about how some of the red knots will actually drop out of the sky from exhaustion.
Well, it's hard to pin a cause of death on a flock that shrinks. But yeah, I mean, imagine what these flights are like. I mean, one flight that seems particularly tough to me is the southbound flight from Quebec to the northern coast of South America. You have to fly over the Atlantic Ocean during hurricane season. And with, again, I believe, climate change, you've got ever heated air, ever heated water, and ever choppier air. So it's not just the incidence of more hurricanes and named storms. It's just that the air is choppier, more turbulent, takes more energy to zip through all of that. It's a really tough life. I guess that's one thing I learned about shorebirds, especially these shorebirds, is that their lives are very, very hard.
Philip Hose is with us. His new book is called Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with a Great Survivor, B95. He's coming to Salt Lake City this Friday, February 16th. It's an event at the King's English Bookshop. It starts at 6 o'clock. We'll give you the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Philip Hose. We're talking about his new book, Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with the Great Survivor, B95. Hose is coming to Utah this week, and we'll give you details about that as we go along. So the population of the red knot crashed. Do we have any sense of whether a species like this could, Philip Hose, alter its migration pattern? It could evolve in some way, adapt in some way?
I think there is some evidence that's possible. I'm not sure that enough of them can to really save the life form, the subspecies, but there's certainly evidence that they are not birds that are like baseball players that run in a straight line to first base and then in a straight line to second and straight line to third and so forth. There are new devices called geolocators that can be affixed to the bird – to a leg of a bird. They weigh about as much as a paperclip. And if you can put that device on a bird and then take it off perhaps a year later, it operates. It gives information almost the way a sextant does with longitudinal and latitudinal readings each day. So you can know where that bird was every day of its year-long journey. And we now have probably 50 or 75 birds that have had these geolocators, and we've been able to read the data, and we find that their lives are even tougher than we thought. I mean, some of the flights are incredibly long, But the straight lines that we, you know, sort of imagined, they go from point A to point B. They do all sorts of weird things. You know, they in one instance, after a long flight, went backwards 250 miles.
Wow.
Who knew? You know, why? Many of them are blown off course by storms, and they have this great sense of just outrunning the storm until, you know, it's safe, hanging out for a little bit somewhere if they can, turning around and going right back. So I think, you know, to answer your question, is there variability in the routes, and could they change the routes? There's definitely variability. Whether enough of them can change quickly enough, mm-hmm. and whether a safe passage can be found that's reliable for them year after year, that's the harder stuff.
At the end of the book, you ruminate on this matter of extinction and write about the fact that we're in the sixth wave of extinction. This is the wave, of course, influenced by humankind. B95, you call a bird of the sixth wave. What do you figure it's going to take to save the red knot?
Well, you know, I think not many people know about shorebirds.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who have never noticed them. So it will take some education, and I'm hoping that my book, Moonbird, will help there by giving us a charismatic character that we can love, you know. But beyond that, we'll have to look at beaches and shorelines in a different way and try to keep them healthy and try to maintain enough of a food resource for these birds. I think nations and states will have to cooperate in ways that they're not used to doing. But again, maybe a bird like this, maybe an issue like this can pull people together. Because when you do look at them, at shorebirds, your heart goes out to them. Mm. They're wonderful. They're beautiful. They can change their bodies to do anything they need to do. I mean, imagine being a school kid and having a final coming up and be able to grow your brain. That's the kind of thing they seem to be able to do. So when you look at them, it's really hard not to love and admire and appreciate them. And one of the great things in my research that I found is I found all sorts of young people. Yeah. Who are really into these birds and who are forming clubs and groups trying to save them, who are writing about them, and not just in the United States, in Argentina especially. You know, B95 is a rock star down there.
Yeah. You know, you say that you ask this really good question in the book, why should people care about a bird like this? I mean, you can't feed them. As you pointed out earlier in the show, they won't curl up on your lap. They don't even visit feeders. And so the question is, why devote time and energy to protecting them? And all these biologists who've devoted their lives to sort of figuring them out and trying to protect them, I guess the question is, why should they? Do you think you have a good answer?
Oh, I don't know. I think the answer is that everything has intrinsic value. Everything, you know, deserves the right to keep going. But these birds in particular are fascinating. And when you look at them, they're remarkably tough and resilient and adaptable. And I think, you know, a challenge like this is a great challenge. Can you love something enough to work for it, to help it, even if it's not your offspring, even if it won't curl up in your lap as a pet would? Can you care about something that's in a way that far removed from your personal life? It's a great challenge, but I hate to imagine a world that is poor and devoid of life forms. I mean, everything I've ever looked at, Doug, is fascinating if you look at it closely and try to look at it on their terms. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge, is to try to look at creatures, you know, on their own terms and try to help them.
Let me ask this finally. So I guess the last time B95 was spotted, this was probably May. He's approaching 20 years old right now, I guess. What's your hunch? Do you think he's still alive?
Yeah, I do. I think he's in if I had to guess, I say that he is at Bahia Lomas, which is in way, way far south Chile. He was last seen May 28th at Reed's Beach in New Jersey by, ironically, I guess it's not so ironic, Patricia Gonzalez, who banded him and who was my mentor. But he hasn't been seen this winter. And the normal place where you look for him in Rio Grande, the flock that's down there has been very small. But they've found a much bigger flock, which includes a number of birds which have those orange Argentine bands on their upper legs. So I think that's where he is. I think he's at Bahia Lomas, and I'm hoping that we'll see him again in Delaware Bay this May.
Philip Hose, he's author of many books, his newest, of course, called Moonbird, A Year on the Wind with the Great Survivor, B95. He's going to be here in Salt Lake City this Friday for an event at the King's English Bookshop. We have more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Philip Hose joined us today from a studio in Portland, Maine. And Philip, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure, Doug. It's great to talk with you again.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.